Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. There's been intense fighting across Israel's northern border with Lebanon overnight and into this morning. A barrage of around 150 rockets was fired into Israel by Hezbollah fighters, as well as drone strikes. Sirens sounded over large parts of northern Israel and thousands rushed to shelters. These latest strikes come following the coordinated attacks on Hezbollah communications equipment last week and a major Israeli strike in southern Beirut on Thursday that killed 45 people, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry. Well, Israel said it killed several Hezbollah commanders in that strike and has continued to pound Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon overnight. Israeli air defences intercepted many rockets, but some reached far into Israel, as far south as the port city of Haifa. Aichia Itzchaki is one resident who said a rocket partially damaged his house.
We are living here, three houses from here. And it happened this morning, around 6:30. There was an alarm, and then immediately afterwards, a big explosion, very, very big explosion. Even three or four houses from here, our window in the main room was completely destroyed, and the ventilator fell down.
Well, speaking on the Trevor Phillips on Sunday show, which is a UK news show on the Sky News channel, the Israeli president, Isaac Herzog, blamed Hezbollah for provoking a dangerous escalation in the conflict.
It is clearly a very dangerous situation and clearly has a potential of escalating dramatically. But we have to understand the situation in a fascia, meaning Hezbollah started this war. It started following the horrendous attack of Hamas on October 7th. Hezbollah since then has been bombarding us endlessly. Almost 100,000 Israelis have been evacuated from their homes. The entire north has been shattered. We kept on being restrained and restrained and restrained. But something has to end. We have to bring our citizens back to their homes. That's the most natural obligation of any nation to its citizens.
Israeli President Isaac Herzog speaking to Sky News earlier today. Well, Hezbollah is widely considered a terror organisation by many Western states and is backed by the Iranian government. It does have support within Lebanon, though, with several MPs in parliament and ministers in the government. A short time ago, I spoke to Abir Bassem, who's a journalist with the Hezbollah-owned news website, Al-Had News, alahadnews.com. And I asked her first, how damaged is Hezbollah's capability after almost a week of attacks?
It's not Hezbollah capacity that has been damaged. It is civilians who have been targeted. I mean, there are women, children, and civilians. It's mostly civilians. Of course, some leaders in Hezbollah or fighters in Hezbollah have been injured in these horrible terrorist cyber attacks. But these attacks were not excluded to fighters.
Certainly, there have been civilian casualties. We've heard that from doctors in Lebanon who've treated children. But we know that around 3,000 people were injured in those pager attacks. And a lot of medics we spoke to said that most of those people they treated were men, young to middle aged. And then we hear on Friday that around 12 senior commanders of Hezbollah were killed in that Israeli airstrike in southern Beirut.
Yeah, this is a whole different thing. In the airstrike, they bombarded a whole building, 7 or 9 stories building, that was knocked down full with families. It's not only 12 commanders were killed, also civilians were killed in this building. But you ask me, did this affect Hezbollah commanding ability or fighting ability? I say to you, no. Abbas al-Musawi was the general commander of Hezbollah and was assassinated by the Israelis in 1992. But this did not affect the power of Hezbollah. He was as important as Sayyid Nasrullah now. And this did not affect the military ability of Hezbollah because, I mean, there are people to be in charge in case of losses.
What will Hezbollah do next?
Well, they have been doing what they usually do. They say they will continue to support Gaza. They will not stop bombarding military Israeli positions until the Israelis stop killing innocent people in Gaza. Another thing is, I don't know if you heard, but early in the morning, Rafael company was totally destroyed, which is a high-tech company. This is retaliation for the terrorist cyber attack on innocent people. And also, Hezbollah bombarded a military airport near Haifa. But still, the peak of the response for the assassination of Commander Ibrahim Aqil has not come yet. When it is done, they will declare, now we retaliated for the assassination of these high-ranked leaders.
Okay, I mean, you say that Hezbollah are doing this on behalf of the people of Gaza, but for ordinary civilians in Lebanon who don't want to be dragged into this war, who are now frightened because there are bombs going off, surely Hezbollah has a responsibility to the people of Lebanon that don't want to be drawn into this war.
Well, first of all, Hezbollah is supported by the government and by the army. It's a kind of a trio pact in parliament.
Hezbollah has seats in parliament, yeah.
Of course. And in the declaration of the Lebanese government, they say they have a trio pact between the people, the army, and the resistance.
A trio
Not
pact.
Hezbollah. A trio pact, yes, with the resistance. The resistance means Hezbollah and others trying to support Gaza.
Israel would say that its entire war in Gaza is to protect its own civilians because they were the ones that came under attack first, and that it's an act of self-defense that Israel is prosecuting this war.
You say,
in
not
Gaza. No,
me.
I'm not. I'm just saying the Israeli government would say that. I'd just like to ask you about the dangers of this escalating into a regional war, which is something that it seems all sides in the region have been worried about. And it does seem as if the Iranian government does not want a regional war with Israel. Their ambassador was hurt in Beirut in those attacks, the pager attacks last week.
Yes.
Is Hezbollah not dangerously close to tipping this into that?
Okay, you say Hezbollah is tipping into that. I say Israel wants war with Lebanon. They have been preparing for this war, and what happened in Gaza on the 7th of October prevented this war on Lebanon. This is what is our reading here as journalists and political analysts on the matter. This is one thing. The other thing, Hezbollah does not want war, not in South Lebanon, not in Lebanon, not in anywhere. What they are doing is supporting Gaza, and they have been declaring several times, stop war on Gaza and we stop bombarding.
And is that what it would take?
The important issue, Israel has a problem with those who were displaced from the northern colonies, the Israeli northern colonies, and they want to bring them back by force without any agreement. They don't want to go through agreement, and that agreement would be to stop war on Gaza, let the Palestinians go back to their places and rebuild their houses and areas and stop attacking them and withdrawing from Gaza. Israel does not want to do that. If there is a ceasefire and the people of Gaza return to their places and their houses and rebuild their houses, destroyed houses, then Hezbollah, yes, will stop bombarding any Israeli position or site in Palestine.
That was Abir Bassem there, who's a journalist with the Hezbollah-owned news website, alaheadnews.com. Well, we can now join our correspondent, Paul Adams, who's in northern Israel, and we were hearing about the intense fighting across the border overnight. Paul, what can you tell us about that?
I hate to disappoint you. I'm not in northern Israel at all. I'm in Jerusalem.
Apologies.
So we are following
I've had the wrong information.
From a distance.
Sure.
But clearly this has been a day in which we have seen Hezbollah trying to up the ante in response to a series of, you know, devastating blows that it has been on the receiving end in the last week, trying to show to the Israeli public and the Israeli government that it is still a potent fighting force, something which is well known here. You know, this is an organization backed by Iran with an absolutely colossal arsenal of missiles and other weapons. You know, it dwarfs Hamas in size and capability. Everyone here knows that. And so evidence that they were using some longer range missiles, longer range rockets today in the firing towards the city of Haifa, for example, will be deemed to be an alarming signal and something that the Israeli government will obviously need to take account of as it tries to figure out how to confront this threat.
And on the subject of potential escalation, Paul, we noticed that the Islamic Resistance in Iraq says that it joined the attack overnight.
Yes, in a fairly modest way, it seems. Possibly a couple of ballistic missiles, maybe a drone as well. It's not thought that any of that did any damage. In fact, I think the Israelis said that those missiles were downed outside of Israeli airspace. But it was evidence that there was a degree of coordination between Hezbollah and other Iranian-backed militias in the region. I should say, by the way, that there's no evidence that we have heard or seen that Hezbollah's claim to have destroyed the Rafael company is true. Okay. They said they targeted it, but we are not seeing any evidence that it was hit. The same should go for the military airbase that was also targeted. No evidence that either was actually hit.
Okay, obviously new information coming all the time, Paul. Just one other thing to bring up with you. In other news, Israeli forces have raided the offices of the news organisation Al Jazeera today in the occupied West Bank.
Yeah, this is part of an ongoing campaign by Israel against Al Jazeera, a news organization that it regards as extremely hostile to Israel. It closed down their operations here in Jerusalem. They have had to concentrate their efforts in the West Bank, in Ramallah. That is an area ostensibly under complete Palestinian civil and police control. But the Israeli military went in there in the early hours of this morning, brandishing a closure order for 45 days. I don't know the exact reason that was given on that order, but the staff there were given 10 minutes to pick up their personal belongings and leave. You know, this is an organization whose journalists in some cases have been killed, obviously not just during the last 12 months, but before that, with the death of Shireen Abu Akleh in 2022, and several Al Jazeera journalists in Gaza during the war. Mm. So it is a running conflict.
Paul, we must leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us. Paul Adams there, live from Jerusalem. Still to come on the programme, British actor Tom Conti talks to us. He was a guest star on the hit show Friends, which is 30 years old.
When I was asked to do it, and I said to the family that I'd been asked to do it, if I had said I've just been asked to do a movie with Robert De Niro and Dustin Hoffman, they would have said, oh, that's very nice. When I said I've been asked to do some episodes of Friends, they went crazy.
More on that interview to come. And a reminder of our headlines this hour. As we've been hearing, Israel has come under attack from rockets and missiles fired by Hezbollah in Lebanon, as well as drones launched by a pro-Iranian group in Iraq. And Malaysian police say they've now arrested more than 350 people during an investigation into abuse at children's care homes. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Russian dissident Vladimir Karamurza was one of the 24 prisoners released in the largest prisoner exchange between Russia and the West since the Cold War. That was back on the 1st of August. Mr. Karamurza is an author, an activist, and one of the Kremlin's most vocal critics. He was serving a 25-year sentence on charges of high treason after criticising the war in Ukraine and he'd already served nearly a year in solitary confinement. He and his wife, Yevgenia, are in London at the moment and have been speaking to the BBC's Laura Koonsberg, 6 weeks on from his freedom. Does it feel real?
The answer to your question is very simple. No, it doesn't feel real at all. In fact, for the past 6 weeks since the prisoner exchange, it has felt as if I've been watching some kind of a film. It's a very good one, but it still does not feel real because, you know, just a few weeks ago, I was sitting in my 2x3 meter cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security prison in Siberia, thinking that I was never getting out of there. And here I am sitting with you, speaking here in London.
Does it feel real for you, Yevgenia?
I think that I'm in a whirlwind of emotions, honestly, because we haven't had time to process anything. And yes, I do feel an immense joy at having Vladimir back with us, at seeing him with our kids, at knowing that he's alive yet again, you know, having survived two assassination attempts and now this prison sentence, including 11 months in solitary confinement in horrendous conditions. He's yet again alive and relatively healthy with us. But at the same time, I feel something similar to guilt, thinking about all the others who are left behind. There's still millions of families torn apart by the war in Ukraine and by repression in Russia.
Let's go back then to that morning in the early hours of the 28th of July. You were in your cell. Suddenly, a group of officers burst in. What went through your mind?
I was asleep when suddenly the doors to my prison cell burst open and a group of prison officers barged in. I was woken up. I saw that it was dark. I asked what time it was. They said 3 a.m. And they told me to get up and get ready in 10 minutes. And at that moment, I was absolutely certain that I was being let out to be executed. But instead of the nearby wood, they took me to the airport, handcuffed with a prison convoy, boarded me on a plane and flew me to Moscow.
And what did you feel when you saw the people with whom you were being swapped? So a prisoner swap, of course, means people like you who've fought for human rights for a long time and who were punished for your political views. But you were swapped for Russians on the other side.
We only saw them from their backs when we were in that bus where the exchange actually took place. It was on the tarmac of Ankara's International Airport in the military wing. And once the swap was officially complete, we saw the others, including Vadim Krasikov, Putin's hitman, who was serving time in Germany, walking up into the same plane that had just brought us from Moscow. It was very much an unequal exchange, because on the one side were people who'd never committed any crime in their lives, because the only reason that my colleagues and I were in prison is because we happened to have an opinion that's different from the opinion of Vladimir Putin. And on the other side, there were actual criminals, spies, hackers, a murderer who's killed someone in broad daylight in the middle of Berlin. And so I understand the moral apprehension of some people about this. I fully understand the argument. But to me, democracy is about difficult decisions. You know, easy decisions are for dictatorships when everything is decided like this on a whim of one individual. Democracy is about difficult decisions. 16 people, 16 human souls were saved from the hell of Vladimir Putin's gulag. Isn't that worth releasing one assassin?
Yevgenia, I remember you telling us that you slept with your phone because at any point a call could come with the best news or the worst news. Can you tell us when the call came that he was to be freed and what did you feel?
On the eve of that day, I received a call from the White House and the kids and I were invited to meet, to join the US President at the White House on the following day. And we were there at 9 a.m. in the morning. We only met the president at 11:30. And only after, only in retrospect, did I realize that we were actually waiting, the president himself was waiting for the actual exchange to take place. Because when he invited us, all the families, all four families, into the Oval Office, he told us that we would make phone calls to our loved ones.
Алло, алло.
Алло, алло. Алло,
пап.
Да, Катюшечка, это
да,
ты?
Да, пап, привет.
Привет, маленький.
Привет, хорошо тебя слышать.
Вы там где?
We're in the Oval Office.
There is footage of that moment and of that phone call taking place. And watching the footage is incredibly powerful. But what was it like for the two of you? I mean, what was it like to hear his voice and know he was safe?
Honestly, I think I couldn't believe this was happening. And I was... I felt as if I was seeing it all through the eyes of our kids. So that footage where I see our kids, when I hear tears of joy in their voices, that will forever make me cry, I think.
I was there in Ankara after the exchange was officially completed. We were all driven to some sort of a government terminal, the big reception area. And then as if things couldn't get any more surreal at that point, a lady walks up to me holding a mobile phone. And she asks, "Are you Mr. Karamurza?" I said, "Yes, I am." She said, "I'm a diplomat from the U.S. Embassy in Ankara. The President of the United States is going to speak to you on the line." And she hands me the phone. And then I hear Joe Biden on the phone.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just want you to know that you've done a wonderful thing by saving so many people. I think there are 16 of us on the plane. Again, I still can't believe it's happening.
So I said something to him, and then he passed the phone to my family, to my wife and kids who were standing there with him in the Oval Office.
I have to ask, was it worth it for all the suffering you went through in terrible conditions, taking a principled stand, fighting for what you believe in?
Answer number one, as a father, as a husband, as a human being, I regretted it every minute of every day that I was away from my family, that I wasn't able to hug my wife or even hear my children's voices on the phone. That's answer number one. Answer number two, just as truthful, just as honest. As a Russian politician, not only have I never regretted it, but it just could not have been any other way. Because I've always been of a firm conviction that a politician has to be in their own country. It's not possible. How could I have called on my fellow Russian citizens to stand up and resist the Putin dictatorship if I didn't do it myself, if I was sitting somewhere in faraway safety? I mean, it would be hypocritical, it would be unethical, it would be impossible. I think Russia deserves a better future than to live under an archaic, murderous, aggressive dictatorship that it's lived under for the past 25 years. I believe Russia should be a normal, modern, democratic European country, and I'm going to continue working towards that goal, whatever it takes.
Can you see a day when you will go back? And would you still fear for your life if you do?
You know, when our plane was taking off from Vnukovo Airport in Moscow en route to Ankara on the 1st of August, the FSB officer, who was my personal escort sitting next to me, turned to me and said, "Look out the window. This is the last time you're seeing your motherland." And I just laughed in his face and I said, "Look, man, I am a historian. I don't just think, I don't just believe, I know that I'll be back home in Russia. And it's going to happen much sooner than you can imagine."
The words of the Russian dissident Vladimir Karamurza there. And we also heard from his wife, Evgenia. They were speaking to the BBC's Laura Koonsberg. Do stay with us. More to come from NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. To South Africa now, where a project to bring quality, affordable healthcare to people who otherwise wouldn't have access to it has helped at least 640,000 patients over the past three decades. Various health clinics and a pharmacy travel about the country on two trains. It's so popular that people often have to queue overnight. But as Mpo Lakaje reports from Soweto, a township of Johannesburg, most people think it is worth waiting for.
As I made my way into the station, I saw a sleek grey train, 19 carriages long. It's called the Transnet Pelopepa healthcare train. Pelopepa means good clean health. Mostly older women are sitting, waiting patiently to be seen. One of them is Solufelo Lutya, who is waiting for a dental appointment.
I'm here to come and clean my teeth. I think it's 1 year. I have a problem with my teeth, so I don't like the way I smile. It's much cheaper than when I go to the dentist.
Passing a lens cutting machine, I got talking to Zongezile Makuvu. Zongezile was prepared to wait, as he knew he'd get an eye test and new glasses for 30 rand. That's less than $2. At a local clinic, he would have paid 10 times as much.
people do not have money, people are unemployed. So once an opportunity like this comes, people will come in large numbers. The service is way better than the local clinics.
I next headed down the train to the dental clinic.
Whoa, lots of children this side of the train. I think they are from the same school.
Anyone under 16 gets services on the train for free, as I heard from the lead dentist, Dr. Agnes Ramutla.
So here we offer services that you find at a maybe a local hospital. So that will be your cleanings and your fillings and extractions. I like helping communities. It's like we are their last hope. So a day we can even see more than 100. I'm very passionate about dentistry. So this is like a dream.
The train service really relies on medical students like Thembelihle Dube. Students work on the train for a fortnight during their final year of studies.
Usually at school you would see 2-3 patients a day, but here we go as far as seeing 120 patients on a daily basis, so it is extremely hectic. A part of my passion doing dentistry was to help people, and that's exactly what we are doing here, bringing smiles. You know, when people leave, they're like, oh, thank you very much, I can smile now and I'm happier. That's exactly what our job is to do.
What a great idea. That report was by Mpola Kaje, and you can hear more about the healthcare trains on People Fixing the World wherever you get your BBC podcasts. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. The civil war that's been raging in Sudan between the army and the Rapid Support Forces Militia, or RSF, for the past 18 months has thrown the country into total desperation. Half the population, that's around 25 million people, do not have enough to eat. Starvation is widespread, and some 12 million have been displaced. A UN fact-finding mission says it has new evidence of war crimes on both sides, and for some time, human rights organisations and others have said that foreign states have been fueling the violence, backing one or other warring side, channeling the arms and supplies that have perpetuated this war. Now an investigation by the New York Times says it's found evidence that the United Arab Emirates is smuggling arms into the country under the banner of the well-respected aid agency, the Red Crescent. I've been speaking to the journalist behind that report, Declan Walsh, and he began with the details of those specific allegations. So what evidence does he have to support it?
Some of it comes from the UAE itself. When this operation started about 15 months ago from this airport in Amjaris in eastern Chad, the UAE released a lot of photographs and press releases in which they vaunted this humanitarian effort that they said was to help Sudanese refugees. And so there was many cargo planes that arrived at this airport carrying aid that was effectively under the banner of the Emirates Red Crescent. And the Emirates also set up this field hospital on the edge of the tarmac in the airport that was also being run by the Red Crescent, which they said would also help Sudanese refugees. But in reality, what our reporting has showed is that some of those cargo planes were also carrying weapons that were later smuggled to the RSF, that RSF wounded fighters had also been treated at this facility, and some of them had been airlifted to the United Arab Emirates for further treatment. And then more recently, we found evidence that the Emirates has been flying these very powerful Chinese-built drones from the same airfield in support of RSF operations, particularly in Western Sudan and particularly in the city of El Fasher.
So these are very serious allegations. Has the Red Cross or Red Crescent had anything to say about this? Because it could compromise their operations everywhere, couldn't it? And isn't it a breach of the way that they operate under the Geneva Conventions?
Yes, so this news has been a source of some alarm at the headquarters of the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement in Switzerland. Apart from being one of the world's oldest and probably best known aid movements, their reputation is really founded on this cornerstone of neutrality. So when we reached out to the Red Cross headquarters, they explained that this was a matter of concern for them and that they had sent two delegations to Chad to try and effectively get to the bottom of it in October of last year and again in March of this year. But they told us that when those teams arrived in the town of Amjaras in the far east of Chad, that they were not allowed to enter this field hospital, which was being operated effectively under their name. And so they had to return to Switzerland. And they said that, their efforts to get answers from the Emirates Red Crescent are continuing. As part of our reporting, we reached out to the Emirates Red Crescent. We sent them a detailed list of questions, but they did not respond.
Interesting. So the main HQ doesn't necessarily know what's going on there. I mean, just on that, you say you've got this evidence. How did you manage to gather that? Because it's so difficult to report from there and to get a clear picture of what's happening.
It's very difficult. We've been reporting it for the last year. It became clear in the opening months of this operation starting in 2023 that, you know, flight trackers were seeing this large number of cargo flights going into this very remote airport near the Sudanese border in Chad. We reported at the time that there was this arms smuggling operation that appeared to be starting. And that information was backed up last January by a report from the United Nations panel on Sudan, whose investigators found their own evidence that the United Arab Emirates was smuggling weapons to the RSF through this airport. And what's happened over the last 6 months is that as scrutiny has increased, the UAE has doubled down on its denials. It has participated in international diplomacy to try to bring peace to Sudan. It's donated tens of millions of dollars to aid agencies that are helping Sudanese refugees. Yeah. But at the same time, these operations to help the RSF have continued and probably escalated in the form of these very sophisticated drones.
Well, that's what's so strange about this, because it's completely at odds with what they're saying, the UAE government is saying in public, isn't it? Including calling for an immediate ceasefire. I mean, what would be the strategy for taking sides in an armed conflict like this?
Well, broadly speaking, this is a war that has been greatly complicated by the involvement of many foreign powers on both sides. The Emirates are by far and away the largest foreign sponsor for the RSF, but on the army side, they have turned to Iran for armed drones. They've been negotiating with Russia over a potential arms deal. Egypt has backed them as well. And there are other countries in the region who appear to be taking one side or the other. So, you know, the Emirati involvement is part of a broader picture of this war that started out, as you know, as a sort of battle between these two generals and their sides inside the Sudanese security services or military, and now has metastasized into this much larger conflagration that has consumed the whole country and now involves all these other foreign countries.
But what's in it for those countries? Why do they want some sort of input into Sudan in particular?
It's a mix of reasons. It's Africa's third largest country. It's very strategically located close to the Red Sea. It's in the Sahel, which, of course, is a region that has its own band of increasing turmoil in recent months. It is Africa's third largest gold producer. It has enormous agricultural potential. But for a lot of these countries, specifically what is important is Sudan's long coastline along the Red Sea. Both the United Emirates, Arab Emirates and Russia have tried to strike deals or been in talks with Sudanese authorities even before this war to try and set up ports there. The Russians want to be able to bring their warships to that area.
We have also tried to contact the UAE government this morning, so far without success. But have they been challenged on this issue by anyone?
They're increasingly facing scrutiny, certainly from Sudanese civil society. They are facing private scrutiny from American officials. Our reporting showed that senior American officials, including Vice President Kamala Harris, have challenged Emirati officials in private, including their leader, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, about this support for the RSF. They've challenged them sometimes by showing them American intelligence in order to try and persuade them to stop the support for the RSF. It seems that hasn't been very successful right now, but it's possibly going to be a focus in the coming days because Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, the leader of the Emirates, is due to meet with both President Biden and Vice President Harris at the White House tomorrow. That's going to be the first ever visit by an Emirati leader to the White House. Those countries have a lot of other interests in common, but it does seem likely that the issue of Sudan and its support to the RSF will come up during that visit.
And that was Declan Walsh, Africa correspondent for the New York Times, speaking to us earlier. Right, let's head to Sri Lanka now, because we hear that a second round of vote counting is underway in its presidential election. At the moment, it looks as if the opposition candidate, Anura Kumara Dasanayake, is in the lead. It is the first presidential election in the country since the economic crisis about 2 years ago, which meant the country defaulted on its debts. And it is the first time in the country's history that this second preference voting is being counted. This is because no single candidate won more than 50% of the vote needed to be declared the winner in the first round of counting. Let's see what we can find out now, because we're joined by Dr. Ahilan Kadirgama, who's a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Jaffna. Welcome to the programme, sir. How do you read this current situation and the fact that we're having now to go to the second preference count?
Yeah, I think this morning it was clear that Anura Kumara Dasanayake, the candidate of NPP, which only polled 3% or 4% in the last presidential election, that there's been a wave and that they were going to win. But this is the first time also that there's been such a three-way race with him, the incumbent president, and the leader of the opposition, Sajid Premadasa. Now, the president has been knocked out of the race since he came third. And since neither of the other candidates got 50% of the vote, this is the first time that we are doing this preference vote counting. And it's expected that anytime now, possibly in the next hour or so, that the Election Commission would announce the winner, and it's likely to be Anura Kumara Dasanayake. So in a sense, this is a historic election. There was a lot of calls for change from the people, and this is the first time that established political parties are going to be displaced. The Colombo elite is going to lose control of state power. So there's a lot at stake. And now, of course, the challenge of forming a new government, because soon after this presidential elections, there's likely to be parliamentary elections in the next 2 months or so.
So it does seem as if the country is on the brink of seismic change politically. Would it be fair to say that, you know, most people have had confidence in the process, even now that we're going to the second preference counting, which is a bit unusual? But, you know, do people feel happy that the process has gone well?
I think so. I think the whole process and the Election Commission has done a fairly good job of educating the people about the process and preparing them. So in that sense, I think people are probably satisfied with this process. And this is one of the elections where there's been the least amount of election-related violence as well. So in that sense, so far, it has been very peaceful. And I think this process has been welcome in that sense.
And you mentioned that it's been very close between the two opposition leaders. And of course, we've got parliamentary elections again. Do you see that there's a way that maybe there could be some kind of collaboration between these two opposition parties going forward?
With the parliamentary elections coming up again, there's going to be a lot of mobilizing and a lot of competition. So unlikely in the near term, but once the parliament is elected, if the party of the president, though, with this sort of momentum, they're likely to make gains, but they may not necessarily get a full majority in parliament.
Okay.
Then they would have to think of some kind of coalition politics. And there are many possibilities in terms of how those coalitions would be formed.
Which we'll have to come back to another time. I'm so sorry. Dr. Ahilan Kadir Gama, thanks so much for joining us live from the University of Jaffna in Sri Lanka. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC World Service. Now, the hit comedy show Friends first appeared on TV screens a whopping 30 years ago today, and it went on to dominate 90s TV in the US and beyond. It's actually making a bit of a comeback now on streaming sites, so a whole new generation is catching up with the six main characters, three women and three men, in their mid-20s, in the first series at least, wrestling with finding jobs, love, and drinking vast amounts of coffee as they go. Well, the six stars became household names, and the show also featured cameo performances from the likes of Julia Roberts, Brad Pitt, and British actor Tom Conti, who played Ross Geller's father-in-law. One of them, anyway. Here's a reminder.
Here comes my dad and stepmom, Mr. and Mrs. Geller.
How are you?
This is Stephen and Andrea Waltham.
How do you do? How do you do? Very nice to meet you. Darling, the Gallows. Darling, it's the Gallows. She's very self-involved, you know. I should never have married her.
Well, I caught up with Tom Conti earlier, and he told me what it was like to be part of the gang.
Well, it was one of the nicest jobs I've ever had. I was astounded when I read it was 30 years. Yes.
But by the time you arrived on the set, it was already an established show, wasn't it? Everybody knew it was a winner already. What was it like to arrive on the set and meet everybody and be part of the gang?
Well, it was one of the nicest jobs I've ever had. When I was asked to do it, and I said to the family that I'd been asked to do it, if I had said, I've just been asked to do a movie with Robert De Niro and Dustin Hoffman, and they would have said, oh, that's very nice. When I said, I've been asked to do some episodes of Friends, they went crazy. I said, oh, my God, how completely amazing and wonderful. So that was a measure of how the show was perceived, you know, by everyone.
Yeah.
It was just hugely popular by then. I think it was series four I was in. So the surprising thing about it was that quite often when people have been working together for years, as that lot had, you know, there's a lot of griping goes on and they've decided not to like each other and all that sort of thing. That didn't happen with them.
Yeah, because you always get this idea that they were friends off the set. But then when you hear stories from Hollywood full of backstabbing and so on, but they really were friends.
They seem to be, absolutely. Yes, I mean, the girls sometimes sat on the boys' knees in rehearsal and such like. You know, they really seemed to like each other, which was wonderful and refreshing.
What do you think it was that made it such a hit? Because, I mean, it really rejuvenated TV comedy at the time, didn't it? And a lot of people talk about the script, people talk about the setup, you know, the fact that it was three boys, three girls. What do you think was the magic chemistry?
Well, the first thing, of course, is always the script. And not only that, but the team leaders who create the atmosphere for working and then choosing, as you say, the right cast. And it's important when you're casting something to choose people who you not only think are good, but you think will be fun to work with and won't be a pain. And I think they were very careful about the casting and they found people who were pleasant, you know, amenable people. And that worked. The other thing that was wonderful about it was that they would take any idea that was funny. If you improvised a line, for example, at rehearsal or at a read-through, and it got a laugh, then that line went into the, you know, you got a page, a rewrite page under your dressing room door, and that line was now officially in the script. You know, if the man who's sweeping the floor of the studio came up with an idea and told someone, if they thought it was funny, they'd put it in the script.
Nice. So a real sort of collaborative process.
Now, completely.
Of course, you came on as Ross Geller's father-in-law, one of them at least, and your character was married to the other British actress, of course, Jennifer Saunders. And
Jennifer.
Your chemistry on screen was pretty hilarious, as we heard in that clip. How did you two get on?
Very well. I mean, Jennifer's delightful and extremely funny. She's just innately funny girl. And so it was, you know, perfect casting. But there was, the fun also was that they were both such absolutely horrible characters. Yeah. So that one got a lot of fun out of that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the point, actually, isn't it? When you are on a set with the six main characters that were very strong roles, they had fantastic lines, how do you make sure, as a cameo, you can stand out in all of that?
Well, you don't make sure. The only thing you can do is just, you know, do what you do. I mean, you know, they've invited you to come. There's a big difference between sitcoms. I only worked on one in this country, between here and America, and that is this collaborative thing. Here, they want you to learn the lines and come along to rehearsal and do it. They want more than that in America. They want you to contribute more than just coming and learning the lines and seeing them on the, you know, they want you to bring something.
More fun, though.
Yes, much more fun. Much more fun. The British, I find the British system extremely one of those things that people wear in straight jackets.
Yeah.
So being in a straight jacket.
I mean, I mentioned earlier that it's getting a bit of a new fan base now, Friends, as all the youngsters are discovering it on streaming sites. But is it still funny? Because it is so much of the 1990s, and some now think the jokes are considered a bit offensive, some of them. What's your view on that?
Well, sometimes when I'm flicking through the channels and I come across it, I watch it, and I still find it funny. If people find it offensive, then they should grow up, really, or go watch something else. Humor is humor, and it doesn't matter, really, on what it's based. Mm. All of those people and all of those scripts were just fundamentally funny. And if you're offended by something in it, then maybe see a shrink.
Or don't watch it, I suppose.
You don't watch it, yeah.
You say how close all the cast members are still, I think, to this day, and that must be very difficult for them now that there's been the tragic loss of Matthew Perry, who played Chandler, who was among the funniest, wasn't he? Had some cracking lines, but he sadly died last year. How has that sort of affected the mood of the cast as it's celebrating?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't have any connection with him anymore, but I think everyone who was involved and who worked with Matt was just shocked beyond belief. We knew that he had troubles and he was fighting demons. Nobody knew how deeply these demons had penetrated him. It was just ghastly. It's difficult, really, to look after people. I mean, the movie business has always been hopeless at looking after people. I mean, lots of people have lost their lives because the movie business was careless, with them, probably the most famous being Marilyn Monroe. But lots of people have died. Mm. No one takes them aside and says, look, here are the dangers. Now, be very careful about this. They don't.
Tom Conti there, Hollywood actor, part of Friends, reflecting on the sad death of Matthew Perry there. Of course, 30 years on from the beginning of Friends, Tom Conti played Ross Geller's father-in-law. That's it for this edition. Stay tuned for the news, which is next.